Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, a new newspaper published cooperatively here in Bristol, online and in print. Also, the final edition, she's going back to Barcelona, of Elia's Tech Roundup. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square. They're on 0117 989 7733. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But we start this week with the Bristol Cable. And I'm joined by Alan Averam. Alan, have I pronounced that right?
Yeah, it's Alon.
Alon, okay. Tell us anyway, what is the Bristol Cable?
The Bristol Cable is a new media publication, a new newspaper that's coming out this autumn, that's run as a cooperative by a collective of people from all across the city. And, you know, we're looking at exploring the issues behind the daily news. So we're going to be focusing on a theme every edition. So the first theme that we're going to be looking at in this first edition, as voted for by the public online, is on pay and inequality in the city. So we're going to be looking into quite a few different areas regarding pay and inequality, looking at working conditions in particular sectors, looking at you know, the role of music, the role of art, the role of you know, the role of the economy of Bristol, both at home and abroad. So yeah, there's quite a few different angles that we're going to be approaching.
Okay, but first of all, hang on, how often is this going to come out? You say this autumn's edition, is the idea it's quarterly?
It's actually, well, it'll be online and it will be continuously kind of uploaded online with more frequent articles, but then there'll be a paper edition which will be free, which will come out once every 2 months.
Okay, but it doesn't really sound like news. A news is got to be kind of daily, really, hasn't it?
Sure. So I mean, we're not really looking at covering the daily news, but we're looking at covering the wider issues behind the daily news.
Now that's a great idea, because I think that's, you know, that's what's missing often when you get a little news soundbite. I noticed something this week, for example, in the I magazine, the independent, their little cheap version, but actually it's got pretty much everything in there, saying that actually for now, even if both couples in the household are earning over the minimum wage, they still don't have enough money to survive on. Now, it's all very well saying lots and lots of people have got jobs, but even if both of a couple are both working and they haven't got enough money to actually make ends meet, this is the sort of thing that often gets missed, I think, in some of the, say, for example, just bald reporting of statistics.
Definitely. And that's why, you know, we're looking at, you know, for instance, statistics, you see in regards to, for instance, employment stats that have been coming out recently in the news, they say one thing on the surface, but to actually have a discussion to visualise that data, one of the things we're going to be doing is creating infographics. We're going to be producing videos, articles, podcasts, and getting a whole range of different voices and opinions to actually discuss all of these items, to get people's personal experiences. So it's not just journalists coming to communities and writing about your lives, but it's you with a pen, it's you with a microphone talking about how it actually is on the ground. And, you know, that paints a totally different picture from the sort of journalism that we currently have in this city today.
Well, you're talking about BBC, because we've got a big BBC regional broadcasting centre, we've got ITV West, and we've got, of course, the notorious Bristol, well, it's not the Evening Post anymore, it's called the Bristol Post, isn't it? I mean, surely, with all those pages every day being churned out at Temple Way by Northcliffe and the Post, I mean, there's no point in having anything else.
Well, you know, I think, as we've seen in the wake of recent scandals, the trust in media as a whole is, you know, at an all-time low, and there is definitely questions that need to be answered in terms of accountability, in terms of trust. And a cooperatively owned media source, we believe, is an answer to that. In regards to, for instance, the Bristol Post, in a leaked document last year, the CEO, David Montgomery, said that he would be handing over a large measure of self-control to public authorities to self-publish on local world local world publications, which the Bristol Post is a part of, which essentially means that the police, hospitals, schools and various public bodies will be able to submit their own press releases. And this obviously raises serious questions as to the investigative function of the press.
Yeah, but surely the Bristol Post will be, and every news organisation uses press releases. That's one of the ways they get the information that goes, you know, then goes into news.
I mean, you can read the report for yourself. I really recommend it. It's out there online. And it really suggests that along with cutting down staff numbers in these various media organisations, the role of the journalist will be to be the curator rather than the investigator, to essentially be collating information and putting it out there rather than having a balance. Because I do agree it is about, you know, hearing what public bodies and institutions have to say, but it's about balancing it with, you know, some investigation of your own as well, and that function risks being lost.
Well, one of the things that's a danger potentially is that journalists, hard pushed, if there's not enough to go around, will simply be tempted to just cut and paste stories from a press release straight into the newspaper. And they do that, definitely do that already, sometimes without even saying this is some kind of an advert. I can remember a couple of years ago when Krispy Kreme donuts came to town, some shop in Cabot Circus, there were articles just straight cut and pasted from Krispy Kreme donuts straight as if they are an article in the Bristol Post.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sloppy form of journalism. You know, people call it churnalism, just churning out articles and churning out material. And you know, we hope to be somewhat bucking that trend on a local level. And we don't, you know, we're a group of volunteers. I was recently working until a few weeks ago in a kitchen. We've got people with filmmaking experience, people with professional writing experience. We're a whole kind of collective coming at it from a whole range of different backgrounds. And we hope to be providing something, you know, a bit refreshing to the media scene in Bristol.
Okay, so how accountable are you? I mean, it's all very well pointing your finger at other news outlets and saying, well, these guys, you know, they're just part of the establishment. But are you accountable and can you prove it?
Well, as of a few days ago, we have just legally registered as a cooperative. So that is, you know, a stark difference to the sort of ownership models which we see in media across the board, with, you know, certain publications in this city even allegedly having accounts in the British Virgin Islands. All of our accounts will be transparent, published online with every edition. And even for our initial funds, we raised the majority of our initial funds, just over $3,000, from a crowdfunding campaign, which I think was, you know, a really humbling display of people in this city who we didn't know, many of them. We put the idea out there online, and they donated their money to realize this. And you know, we've got systems in place where basically the general membership holds absolutely every single staff member in the organization accountable, which is something that you don't really see in other media publications.
Okay, well, what about professionalism? What about professional journalists? If you've got someone that knows what the law is, for example, and knows, has been trained in journalism?
Yeah, thankfully, we've really been touched by all of the different organizations that have come forward to help us and various individuals. We've been assisted recently by Mike Jempson, the head of journalism at UWE, who's an expert in media law and ethics. And just this spring, we ran a series over 35 hours of free media workshops across the city, which were really designed to get people kind of quite a comprehensive understanding of different forms of media production. And one of those sessions was media law and ethics. And we are going to be upholding professionalism and making sure that all of our content is going to be subject to a editorial charter, which has been agreed upon by the membership, and that we can, you know, that we are trustworthy, that we are accountable, and that we abide by the sort of principles which often the publications that are already in existence don't abide by themselves.
Interesting. Well, one of the most important jobs of journalists is investigative. As you say, there's very little of that going on in the city, actually. In fact, generally across the country. I mean, I go back, probably if you go back 20 years, there were loads of TV programmes that were doing investigative journalism. The trouble was, of course, that they cost a lot of money. Often you're chasing down leads that don't lead anywhere, and you know, it needs to be quite a lot of money invested in these things. I remember, for example, the most popular investigative programme ever in Britain, current affairs programme on the television, which was The Cook Report, by Roger Cook, who lives in Wiltshire, actually, still. He was kicked off the airwaves by loads of lies in the News of the World back in the year 2000. His programme even had its own barrister full-time as part of the programme. How on earth are you going to be able to fund investigative journalism?
Well, obviously, we don't have thousands of pounds to be thrown around. The form of journalism that we're really interested in working in is kind of this new form of citizen journalism, which looks at kind of applying some of the old traditional investigative tools and techniques of, filing through companies' house and looking at various sources, but also turning to crowdsourcing of information. So really making public appeals for first-hand testimonies, and that's something that wasn't really available in the age before kind of social media. And one of the things we've been doing in past weeks is putting out an appeal on our Twitter feed, which has been received amazingly, where we've been asking people to get in contact with us and give their stories of working conditions in the catering sector, which is one area which we're investigating at present. And from this appeal on Twitter, we've been meeting up with people from a range of different backgrounds, sharing their stories, following up leads, and there's hundreds of people who we've been in contact with over the past year, who many of whom are in some capacity working on this project. So the workload is spread out across quite a wide range of people. So it's not, burdened on a few individuals to sacrifice all their time. There's some people who work in a day or two a week, and there's some who work in 1 hour every fortnight.
Well, to be fair, Roger Cook used to produce a documentary every week of an hour long.
For sure.
So you're not having to produce quite that amount of content.
Definitely.
Can you just give us an idea of the sorts of things we could expect? Because this is, we've been talking very much in general terms. Mm. You're talking there about catering specifically, and that's one thing I think could be really useful. If you've got people as part of your group, your collective, who have got specialism in a specific area, that enables them to really drill down into that area. But what sort of things more generally across the city are you looking at?
Well, without giving away too much, because we want to keep you interested in and flicking through those pages.
Well, and also you might want to stave off injunctions and things like that to stop you publishing. So you might not want to say too much, but just give us a general idea.
So just to kind of go over what we're doing, we're committed to multimedia, so we're going to be producing all of this journalism in really new and exciting ways, with infographics, podcasts, films, articles. And we're looking at, for instance, the catering sector for one. We're looking at the role of political hip-hop in the city as well. So we're doing some music videos, we're doing some interviews. We're interviewing some celebrities as well, getting their opinions on the issues surrounding inequality in this city, and we're looking at practices on construction sites as well, speaking to people in who have made accusations that blacklisting still goes on in this city. And those are some of the bigger stories that we're investigating.
Yeah, blacklisting's quite a scary one, isn't it? I mean, that was happening at the BBC. I can remember reading a book called Blacklist back in the early 1990s by Richard Norton Taylor, who's now the security correspondent on The Guardian, really drilling down into the way that left-wing people were being weeded out, left-wing producers being weeded out by MI5 at the BBC in a secret blacklist, with a secret room at the BBC where they used to sit in London going through, we don't like the look of that one. And then people would suddenly lose their contracts, lose their jobs in a mysterious way. And we know that that's been happening in the construction industry. People like Balfour Beatty and Kier, that was exposed last year. And it's also, I can imagine, because we had Phil Chamberlain in here talking a few weeks ago about the forthcoming book about blacklisting that he's been working on. So that sounds like a fascinating one, especially if it's able to expose some places around the city where these blacklists are going on, which means, of course, that they won't be safe construction sites. This is the crazy thing about this whole business, is that people on that blacklist have been put there because they're raising issues of health and safety. So they're saying, actually, there could be questions about whether this building site is illegal. And as a result, they're being sacked and made sure that they don't get a job anywhere else. So this is a massively important issue.
Sure. And this is, all of this investigative function of the press that is being eroded away is absolutely vital for any thriving democracy. Not only a thriving democracy, but as you say, safe conditions within our workplaces and holding various powers in our city accountable, engaging in a discussion, having a debate. It's not about ramming down an agenda, but it's about opening up the books and asking people to share their opinions and let's have an honest discussion within an accountable framework.
Fantastic. Okay, Alan Averam, just please finally tell us whereabouts, because there's two ways people might want to engage. First of all, to just look, watch what you're doing on the internet, but people may have some journalistic expertise, they may have a bit of spare time, and they may want to contribute. So where can we find you?
You can find us at www.thebristolcable.org, or if you email us at thebristolcable@gmail.com, and we'll get back to you. And you can find us alternatively on Twitter and Facebook.
Okay, Alan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now it's time for the Tech Roundup with Elia Pablo. Hi, Elia.
Hello.
Now, you've been away for a little while and you're going to be going again back to Barcelona. This is terrible news. What we're going to do, we're not going to know what to do with our smartphones, are we?
You will have to find a new Elia now.
I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll try and drop in some technical tips, tech tips, at some point over the next few weeks and get back to this, because it's so important. Nobody else really seems to be properly reporting on. It's very, very difficult to find info. This week, we're going to start with Facebook. We often talk about Facebook. We talked, didn't we, about their experiments in mind control, making people happy all week or making people sad all week without them realising why. But anyway, this week we've got an advert from Facebook. It's advertising that it's Messenger app. And it's been going for a long time, this, but now the company have gone one step further and removed the chat option from its main app. So users who want to keep chatting have got to download the other app. This seems a strange decision. So why have Facebook done this?
So basically, as you just said, before you could chat through the main app, and Facebook keep reminding you that if you wanted, you could download the Messenger app, which make life easier for you, apparently. But now they basically, like, they now you can't chat through the main app. You have to download the other app, and it's because they are saying it's easier, it's quicker, it has much more possibilities than the main one, and they want to separate their main service to the chat. But what everyone says is it's because they want to control all the messenger, like online messenger through the mobile phones, and that's why they bought WhatsApp. They have this app that was the third one before, it was the third one on the list of Messenger. So they have been trying to get their app on the number one.
Right. So the idea being that everyone that you chat with has got to also have this app.
Exactly.
Right. Now, a lot of people have got Facebook, so this is a good bet, isn't it, that someone's going to have the Facebook Messenger, but then they've separated it off and they're saying, now, if you want to use Messenger, you've got to download this new app. Now, what's the problem with the new app?
The problem with the new app is that you actually, to download it, you have to accept lots of conditions. That is what is making it controversial.
Okay, those conditions. I'm just looking at an article online here by Nick Russo on CBS Local in the United States. He calls the article "Facebook crosses the line with new Facebook Messenger app," and he lists a whole load of things that this new Messenger app does to your phone. Do you want to just go through some of them? Because it's the sort of thing you would think, really, for a Messenger app, it shouldn't be doing all these things to my phone.
Exactly. It's like there's nothing related of actually messaging these new possibilities they are gonna be allowed to do.
So what can these things do to your phone?
I'm just gonna read some of them. Basically, they can call phone numbers and send message from your phone, from your username.
So this is not you sending a message, it's the app sending a message.
Exactly, definitely. They can record audio and take pictures and videos at any time. So they can record your conversations or even when you're just talking with your friend, not using your mobile phone. They
so can say, for example, the phone is sitting on the table while you're having coffee with your friends, they can be recording that?
Yes, because you allow them through downloading this app.
Okay, any more?
Yeah, they read personal profile information stored on your device. They can get a list of accounts known by the phone and other apps you use.
Hang on,
so they basically can have everything you have on your phone.
Well, that is interesting, because I mean, if they've got the accounts that I've got on my phone, they'll also have those passwords.
Yes, I guess so. And like, the you can think, oh, they are going to use all this information for publicity, because they will sell it to advertisement companies and things like that, and it's going to be very useful for them. But they can use it in so many different ways.
Also, that, well, with all those things, I mean, there's actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I can see on that article, that they're saying these different things that it can do to your phone that's got nothing to do with actually messaging. And Nick Russo then summarises at the end of his article. He says, hopefully you take this as seriously as I do. After reading more about it and studying the permissions, I've now deleted this app from my phone and I don't intend to use it ever again. I still have my Facebook app. I just won't use the messaging feature. Unless I'm at a computer, even then I might not use messaging on Facebook anymore. With these kinds of invasions of privacy, I think Facebook is pushing the limits to what people will get away with.
Yes, and I did exactly the same, to be honest. I directly deleted the Messenger app. And the thing is, a weird thing they did, apparently, is like they sent a message, like they met message notification to some users, then the user found out that they had to download the other app to actually read the message. And when they download the app, they didn't have any message. It was just like a trick. So they downloaded the message at that moment. The app.
How interesting. So people are downloading the app so they can read a message. But then once they've downloaded the app, they find there's no message there.
Exactly.
This is just a trick to get into your phone. Okay, folks, Facebook have gone over to the dark side again.
Yeah,
we don't
all
really
over
need.
Again.
So are there any other good messaging systems that people want, if they want to delete their Facebook messaging, are there any other systems that work quite well?
Well, I'm using Telegram right now. It's from Russian company, so some people don't trust it. But it's like, it's all encrypted, and they actually promise a huge amount of money if someone can actually disencrypt its message.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's a little bit more private. Yeah. Facebook, you need to learn a few lessons from Telegram. Come on, Facebook, pull your socks up. Right. The next story we're going to look at this week is from Amazon. It's the main online distributor in terms of books and media. Although the company's increasing every year its profits, they've been fighting this year with a large number of publishers, such as Hachette Book Group and more recently Disney. So what's Amazon looking for with these disputes?
Well, basically what they, with Hachette, they want to get the prices of the online books, the e-books, lower, so they can sell it in less cost and then they will get more profit of it, because they think the cheaper it is, the more they will sell. That's their idea.
Okay, the fight between Amazon and Hachette has become a reason of concern for several authors. Some of them, like Stephen King, Donna Tartt and Philip Pullman, wrote an open letter asking Amazon to stop blocking and delaying sales of Hachette books. So is Amazon truly doing that?
Yes, exactly. Well, they are doing, when they have, they already did it with other companies. When they have a problem, a contract problem with one of them, they just block them. And especially in America, like for the publishers, their main way to sell their books is through Amazon. So that's why it's so important, like what they are doing. Because by blocking them, don't selling their books, for example, there is like this pre-reservations before the book actually go on selling. So they delayed all these options. They cannot, like, users cannot buy their books, or, for example, if they buy one of their books, it will take ages to get them. So it's like kind of bullying and blackmailing.
Bullying and blackmailing, Amazon. Okay, some more bad people on the internet to avoid. Okay, why is the whole book industry looking at this particular case, though? Because it's a lot of people in publishing across the world are keeping their eye on what happens.
Because what the publishers and the authors are saying is that, yes, Amazon wants, like, the books to be cheaper, like the e-books to be cheaper, but that's going to destroy the whole process. Because, for example, let's say if the editorial, well, the publishers every time are having less and less profits, then they won't risk to publish, like, minor authors, or all the little publishers will disappear because they won't have any profits at all. So it's just going to be, like, just a wall of big authors, big publishers, and all the independent culture will disappear.
Well, it sounds like the same sort of bullying that we've had from so many big companies, big multinationals. That is finding its way down to really shave away the livelihoods of some of the best authors. And it's actually crushing creativity.
Yes, that's, and it's like, it seems like it's all about money. What they are doing is culture is about money.
A great pity. And we'll have to end it there. Anyway, Elia Pablo, have a lovely time back in Barcelona. Where are you, what are you going to be up to in the next few weeks then? And whereabouts, and why have you decided to go back?
Well, basically, that's kind of private. My boyfriend got a job, so we are moving there back. And I'm, now that the situation seems to, from time to time, getting better, I'm trying to find a job.
Okay. So. Well, anyway, it's been lovely working with you. And also, thanks for all the information you've been sharing with us to get our heads around this industry of social media. Thanks, Elia.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Jason Yiannopoulos for our weekly look at Private Eye, and also a bit about disability. And we'll start there, I think, Jason, this week.
Oh, okay.
This is on a positive thing for a change. I mean, normally it's to do with Ian Duncan Smith flogging disabled people, cutting them off from benefits, leaving them starving, and this kind of thing. This week, in the Huffington Post, the global disability rights movement winning power, participation and access, it says. This is nothing about us without us, is the global slogan for the disability rights movement.
Correct.
It means nothing should be decided about people with disabilities without their presence, their participation and their inclusion. And it's been evolving for a long time. And basically, what the article, you know, if you go right the way through it, is saying that actually things are looking quite good for the global rights movement.
Yeah, I mean, things are improving.
But what about practically on the ground, though?
Practically on the ground, things are looking not so great in the UK. I mean, we still have our issues here.
It looks like you're going to be starting working for a disability charity soon, Jason, too. Tell us a little bit about that.
The group is called Radiant Disability. They're based in Windsor. I'm actually working for one of their wings, which is Disabilities Our Ability. So I'll be auditing and talking to disabled people about what their needs are and whether they feel that things are adequate with their either their housing or their work. We basically work with companies to ensure that the companies fulfil the provisions of the Equalities Act.
One thing the Huffington Post article looks at is that they believe that that disabled people are becoming more politicised. Do you think that's true?
I think that's absolutely true, and in the current situation, I think we have to be.
Okay, on to Private Eye, talking about political things. And we start this week by looking at Lord Coe. Now, he's a Tory Lord. I know he's slated, or he was anyway, until he said, maybe I'm not interested, to take over the BBC.
Funnily enough, yes, the new BBC Trust Chair will be responsible for enforcing the highest editorial and ethical standards. So it's not completely unexpected that Lord Coe withdrew his application. His record is rather mixed. He was once the chair of the FIFA Ethics Commission in 2006. He was unable to transform FIFA's reputation for, as Gary Lineker adequately put it, nauseating corruption. During Coe's brief tenure, Panorama investigation found that a former chairman of the Scottish FA, John Macbeth, had been told by Jack Warner, former FIFA vice president, at a game between Scotland and Trinidad and Tobago, to make a match fee check payable to him personally. Meanwhile, in 2007, Channel 4's dispatchers questioned Coe's judgment when, a month after London won the Olympic bid in 2005, he set up a sports agency called CLG with former bankrupt and tax exile Peter Abbey, not the most ethical business partner, as it points out. Following the games, Coe sold CLG to Chime Communications in a deal worth just under £2 million with another £10 million potentially payable by 27 depending on profits. Coincidentally, Chime won a string of contracts with both the London organisers and a clutch of 2012 sponsors while Coe chaired the games organising committee.
Oh, so he was making loads of wonga out of it all. So, well, it'd be interesting to see if he ever does take over the Beeb. Anyway, I would have thought it was Labour's turn, isn't it? Since we had Chris Patten, who was a former chairman of the Tory party, another Tory running the BBC could be horrendous. Anyway, Portsmouth.
Yes, well, this is all about Liberal Democrats and, of course, handy Mike Hancock. For those who aren't familiar with the story, Mike Hancock was is still the MP for Portsmouth South, Liberal Democrat. Well, he stopped insisting that he was 100% innocent of charges that he sexually abused a mentally vulnerable constituent. And since then, the Portsmouth Liberal Democrats have been trying to walk away from the wreckage. One of the people hoping to take over the seat after Mike Hancock steps down in the next general election is Gerald Vernon Jackson, the former leader of Portsmouth City Council. He has begun apologising to everyone he can. The more he says sorry, the deeper he digs himself in. Last week, he apologised to the constituent in question, telling her that Andy Hancock had fooled him and he should not have accepted Mike Hancock's assurances. But bear in mind that this happened in 2009. She feels it is a bit late to apologise.
Oh dear. Okay. Julia Goldsworthy, who's she and why is she in private eye?
She's in private eye. It's all about lobbying. And she's going to again be the Liberal Democrat candidate for Camborne, as she was in 2010 when she lost the Tories by 66 votes in the Camborne seat. Rather unfortunately, she's taken up a job as a lobbyist for a communications company, Hanover Communications, where she'll be working for a former Tory press chief, Charles Lewington. As senior policy advisor, Goldsworthy provides strategic advice to Hanover's clients all across a range of policy areas. Its clients include hospital groups and a medical group. Companies deeply involved in NHS privatisation, named as HCA Hospitals and Alliance Medical.
Hang on, they're not privatising the health service, are they? They keep telling us they're not.
Well, it would appear they are.
Oh, well. OK, the next story, you've got part one and part two. This is one of our favourite themes, Jason, arms sales. And, of course, we've got quite a few arms firms in Bristol, as well as the defence procurement up at Filton. So what are the part one and part two of our arms sales story this week?
Downing Street's promise on Monday to review all UK's arms exports licensed to Israel will come as no surprise to anyone who has looked at a recent report from MPs, Scrutiny of Arms Exports and Arms Controls 2014. The report reveals the continuing mystery of licences for £7.8 billion worth of equipment, mainly things such as cryptographic equipment. Sir John Stanley MP told the Commons it seems highly likely that some of the massive cryptographic export to Israel will be used sooner or later to the advantage of the Israeli security services in operations in Gaza.
Oh dear. Okay, part two.
Part two. Well, it's not just Israel that's getting it. The UK is doing the wonderful job once again of funding both sides of a conflict.
Oh dear, both sides of the war.
The UK has been exporting arms to Russia for at least a decade. It's also exporting the same arms to the Ukraine at the same time.
So whoever wins, British arms firms make money.
Pretty much.
And in fact, I wonder this, with this whole ISIS thing in the Middle East, everyone's saying, oh, they've got such amazing weapons, they've got better weapons than the Iraqi army. Well, where did they get them from?
Well, funny enough, it does mention that here. It says the Syrians at least have been sold dual-use chemicals, which could easily be turned into weapons.
Oh, no.
Whilst in Iraq, the jihadists there have been supplied with British weapons, although not by the British. It's some of our clients, Saudi Arabia, have been giving it to them.
Via Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia, the great arms-laundering country of the Middle East. Anyway, on to our final story this week, Jason, and to your hometown of Maidenhead.
Yes.
What's been happening there?
This is our Conservative councillor, Peter Lawless, has been found guilty of fraud.
What a great name for a fraudster.
I think so.
Now, I don't think everybody by the name of Lawless is a fraudster, although, of course, David Laws, who's the Lib Dem MP for Yeovil, down there, Yeovil. He did lie about his expenses, so a massive amount of money.
So his name's David Lawson, he broke a few.
Yes, he certainly did. And then he was invited straight back into the government afterwards. Yeah, I think it was about a year or so he had to do in penury. So, anyway, lovely to chat to you again, Jason. Hopefully we'll see you next week, although I know you're going to be starting your new job soon.
I start in September, so you certainly will.
Okay,
thank you,
Jason.
Tony.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2, your voice, your choice. Well, I'm joined now by Jim from Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Hi, Jim.
Hello there.
Can you tell us what's going on this coming weekend? Because I understand you've got an event. First of all, what are you up to?
Well, like all local groups across the country, we'll be having a local event this Saturday. And we decided to have a picnic on College Green from 12 to 5 in solidarity with Gaza and the other people in Palestine.
Well, why is it you feel so strongly about this?
Well, the immediate answer would be that it's just the horrific recent attacks on Gaza resulting in at least 2,000 people, mainly civilians, being killed by the fourth largest army in the world. That's what animates me.
Okay, well, I mean, the way it's being presented, there are two sides here. I mean, you've got the Palestinians firing rockets at Israel too.
Well, it's a bit like pinpricks versus highly sophisticated technology. I mean, if the British had taken the same attitude during the Troubles of Northern Ireland, we'd have had to shell the whole of West Belfast into rubble. So the issue of proportionality and common human decency, even war, applies, I think.
And what about the history there? Because it was a British protectorate at one point. I mean, I suppose people are bound to say, well, Britain does bear some responsibility.
Britain bears an awful lot of responsibility from the Sykes-Picot Agreement in the First World War. They've basically promised the land to both Palestinians and the Jewish communities. And they didn't resolve it at the end of the Second World War. Another responsibility is obviously the backing of the United States for their own financial and geopolitical reasons.
And what about demonstrations that there have been since the most recent attacks on Gaza by the Israeli Defence Forces? Because there's been a few big ones in London, haven't there? And you're deciding, are you to do occasionally having small events like this picnic here in Bristol interspersed with these big demos in London?
Exactly. The last demo was the fourth one in London, and the largest. I think we estimated 175,000 people, which is huge. After this weekend, we're expecting another demo, the fifth one in London, and there will be local events going on all the time.
Okay, so if people are interested, they can come along on Saturday. Just remind us of the time again.
It's 12 o'clock to 5, and I'd just like to say we'll also be collecting for medical aid, purely medical aid for Palestine as well at this event. So it's both publicity about what's going on in Gaza and also collecting medical aid for all the victims of the indiscriminate bombing.
Okay, and if people are online, can they find the Bristol Palestine Solidarity online?
That's easy. You just go to PSC Bristol and it'll be there online.
Okay, Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now, the origins of war go back millennia, but the modern war is very different. It's about convincing the public that you're doing the right thing by attacking another country. The military-industrial complex has got so powerful, particularly through privatisation of the military with big profits to be made from war, that they're arguably steering foreign policy itself through lobby groups such as the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the Brookings Institution, and the notorious US Council on Foreign Relations. If peace is to prevail, there needs to be a strong peace strategy policy around to beat off those braying for invasions and conducting covert operations, the so-called black ops abroad. Here, Webster Tarpley, the US historian, he goes into real historical depth, including the Machiavellian origins of Venice city-state, about the machinations behind today's complex warfare state. And as he points out, if you don't have a peace policy, you're going to have war.
Othello is an attempt to warn James, watch out for that Iago that you have running the show, that's Cecil, Robert. And then the other one is King Lear, right? In other words, don't, if you're King Lear, don't give your kingdom away to somebody else, Goneril and Regan. But it really means Cecil, because the idea was that King James, in his pedantry and his ineptitude, he really turns the government over to Cecil. And Shakespeare is saying, you can't do that. Not with Cecil, anyway. So Carol Quigley, writing in the 1930s about Lady Astor and the Cliveden set, he writes about the Cecil Bloc, and what he means by that is the Conservative Party. Right? There's a Lord Salisbury who's Prime Minister in the late 19th century, right, during the height of imperialism. So the Cecils are still around. I don't know if they were around, you know, as individual names. I think they are, but I don't know exactly who they are.
How did the Cliveden set operate? I mean, what sort of methods to run the empire and expand the empire?
We just go back a little bit. If you want to, the predicament of the 20th century is basically this, right? That the British Empire in the second half of the 19th century has already begun to decline because there's a failure in mass education here. You haven't opened up your universities for a scientific and technological education for a whole lot more people, because the Oxford-Cambridge aristocratic snob mentality has dominated. And therefore, people, they don't want to do science and technology. There's a much greater prestige attached to dilettanting in literature and history and things like this within this Whig model. So you see the Germans beginning to get ahead, the French beginning to get ahead, even the U.S. begins to get ahead. And so you have this empire which is slowly declining, right? You get in the 1890s, you have a big pound crisis around Barings Bank and the Venezuelan debt crisis. So by the time you get to about the late 1890s, you have a situation which is not good. And then you have the Boer War. Now, here's this. Remember we had the League of Cambrai before, 1509? Everybody gangs up on Venice. Well, when the British in the 1899, right, the Boers of South Africa revolt, and the British have some huge defeats in the first couple of months. And what they see at that point is that they're universally hated. Because what happens at that time is that Count Witte in Russia puts out a bid to Germany and France saying, look, you know, look what they're doing, these British, right? Why don't we have the continental bloc? Let's have an alliance of France, Germany, Russia. And let's stop spending all our money on armaments and let's have a peace race and we'll pull ahead of the British because we won't have this crazy arms race, right? We won't need to be at each other's throats all the time. And there was interest in the circles of a guy called Gabriel Hanotaux, and some others in the French foreign policy establishment. But the person who saved the British Empire at that point is Kaiser Wilhelm, Emperor William of Germany. He's an absolute idiot and an Anglophile. You know, the first thing he wanted when World War I was over, he said, I can finally have another cup of English tea. And he, of course, had this, he had a hate-love relationship with his English mother. So he had a very complex psychology. So that was, you can say that the Boer War is a League of Cambrai moment when it almost came about. If this stupid German emperor hadn't said no, there could have been the continental bloc. And at that point, you know, the Foreign Office divide and conquer stuff would just not have worked anymore. And of course, the king, the Prince of Wales, up until the early 1900s, and he's going to be king for all, but he's been Prince of Wales for about half a century, is Edward VII. So what Edward VII does is he goes into high gear. He's a tremendously important figure. He is the most energetic and successful operative of the House of Hanover, Saxe Coburg Gotha Guelph, by far. And what he does is he creates the Triple Entente. He creates this, the Nutcracker Alliance of Russia and France to crush Germany and Austria-Hungary. And the British fleet, of course, blockades all of them. And that's your recipe for World War I. So if you want to say one person who contributed the most to preparing World War I and allowing it to get going, it's him. Of course, he dies in 1911, but you would have to also add that a lot of the people who actually carry out the war, Admiral Sir Jackie Fisher of the Admiralty, Sir Edward Grey of the Foreign Office, Winston Churchill, they're all personal protégés of Edward VII. So his networks are the ones that take you into this war. Now, the war is, of course, a catastrophe, and it's interesting that in this case, even the aristocracy is massacred on the battlefield, because it just gets to be out of all conceivable proportion. It's World War I is a catastrophe from which we really have never recovered. Nobody has, because World War I is bad enough that out of that you get fascism, communism, depression, and World War II, and a Cold War, and now we've just woken up from that into the hangover of globalism and economic liberalization. But now the aster set. By about, you know, the 1930s, the big fear is Stalin, because Stalin has decided to industrialize the Soviet Union, and he's succeeding, and this is becoming a huge power. So there are people who look around, and of course, you always have a choice, right? The government in London could have said, well, you know, we're going to get out of the Depression, and we're going to go to comprehensive economic development. We're going to have a solid alliance system where we stick with the French and some others, and we will be able to get through it. And indeed, we try to promote economic recovery in Germany, but they didn't do that. They have the reparations going on, right? The world economy is crushed by the Versailles reparations. So what they say is, look, we can't do anything about Stalin, but what we can do is let's create a kamikaze regime in Germany and play them against Russia and get rid of both of them. And what we want to do is put in somebody who's only going to go east. So, of course, there's this demagogue Hitler running around. He's actually a creature of German military intelligence, a Field Marshal Ludendorff, and people like this. So let's put him in. And he's a racist, and he's got this anti-Slav ideology. The problem is he also had an anti-British, anti-French ideology because of the Versailles business. So he's somebody who's going to go in both directions. So what the Clifton set amounts to, and that's Lord Astor, Lord John Jacob Astor, and the other one, two of them, Lady Astor is an aristocratic Confederate from Virginia, Lord Brand, Lord Lothian, Lord Halifax, anyway, a bunch of lords. They represent the pro-Hitler group in the British ruling class. There's also the Duke of Hamilton. There's Lord Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England. And then, of course, you have people like Prescott Bush, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles in the United States. They're all pro-Nazi. And they're all essentially involved in this idea of divide and conquer in Europe. So we're going to build up Hitler. We're going to make sure we get Hitler. In other words, they don't want to have a military government. They don't want to have a democratic government. They want Hitler because they feel that he is a madman, but he's motivated by this racial theory, and that he's going to go east. So they consider him a one-way gun. You can read, all kinds of stuff about the Clifton set. I've written some essays about it myself. Carol Quigley is quite good on many aspects of the Clifton set. So Sir Neville Chamberlain, so-called appeaser, is a creature of this group. That's his social milieu. In other words, where does he go on the weekend? He goes to Cliveden to hobnob with Lady Astor, Lord Astor, and the rest of these people. The specific way they did it was that Lady Astor's hobby was welfare, is it a literacy and health care for poor families, stuff like this. So in one of the Stanley Baldwin governments, Chamberlain, and he's the son of Joseph Chamberlain, who was the mayor of Birmingham, I think, and a great imperialist around the turn of the century. Joseph Chamberlain was a big imperialist ideologue. Neville Chamberlain gets to be the health minister, and Lady Astor cultivates him. That's her specialty, and she eventually gets elected into the parliament, too. So in that way, Chamberlain is drawn into this group, and that way he becomes not an appeaser, because that's not the idea. He becomes pro-Hitler in the sense that he wants to build up Hitler. And a deal might have been possible. In other words, a deal where, for example, Germany took the lead in attacking the Soviets and the British were kind of a benevolent neutral on the side of Hitler. The problem with it was that Hitler said, look, you have a democratic government, and Chamberlain, if you lose the election, how can you guarantee me that the next guy won't be against me? And an interesting thing at this point, the British people generally don't like Hitler, and that's very good. And that's what Hitler points to. He says, look, your population hates me. What if you fall and some other government comes in? How can I be sure that I can trust you?
That was Webster Tarpley there. Webster is the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, as well as the unauthorized biography of George H.W. Bush Sr. And we'll have more from Webster Tarpley in future weeks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
What's on this week? It's Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, Tony. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 15th of August, the Stone Roses tribute act, The Total Stone Roses, will be performing with support at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Into Saturday, 16th of August, it's the Southwest Tribute Festival at Yeovil Showground in Two Tower Lane, Yeovil. It features Legend, who are a tribute to Bob Marley and the Wailers, Oasis, who are a tribute to Oasis, The Killers, who are a tribute to The Killers, and the headliners, Jilted Generation, who are a tribute to The Prodigy. Tickets are £12 each, or you could pay £17, and that includes camping. Camping gates open at 2 p.m, main gates open at 5 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present the Sex Pistols. They formed in 1975 in London, released one album and several singles, and split up in 1978. Since then, there has been numerous reunions, including this one in 1996, which resulted in the album Filthy Liquor Live being released. The song this week is God Save the Queen, a song not against the Queen, but against the regime behind her at the time. Sex Pistols with God Save the Queen. The song actually got to number one in the singles chart when it was released back in 1977, but the BBC decided to bump them down to number two instead. Finally, on Saturday, 16th of August, Poison Idea will be performing with support from Men's Civic and also Seven Crowns at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. And also, as a final reminder, this Saturday, 16th of August, it's the Southwest Tribute Festival at Yeovil Showground in Two Tower Lane, Yeovil. There's tributes to Bob Marley and the Wailers, Oasis, The Killers and The Prodigy. And that's all from me this week. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Lovely. Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Alan Aviron from Bristol Cable, Elia Pablo and Jason Yannakopoulos. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same kite next week. Goodbye for now. She will find